We're speaking with Ralph Nader here at the Techno-Utopianism Conference. And Ralph, I just wanted to get your response to the overall theme of this conference, which seems to be to take a look at technology in a different way, in terms of regulating technology in a way that will serve the commons as opposed to private profit. And as you think about the issue of how more effective and more responsible accountability can be built into our system to put technology to better use, what kind of mechanisms are you thinking that we should be thinking about?
Well, technologies are exploding on all fronts like never before in human history. We know that. Genetically engineering humans, genetic sequences controlled by monopoly patents by the likes of Novartis and Monsanto. We see nanotechnology as sort of a stealth but very, very tumultuous technology where they can develop miniature drones that would fit in your hair and you wouldn't even know it, but you'd be under surveillance. Just to give you one example of this exploding applications here, we have the older technologies, fossil fuels, nuclear power, that are threatening habitation on the earth. We have pharmaceuticals and a combination of food medicines that are breaking out all over, and they're not being regulated adequately. Some of the fossil fuels are, but basically there is no legal or ethical framework of accountability for these new technologies. So as a result, the science is kept secret so that when it comes out the wrong way for genetic engineering in the food area, Monsanto can suppress it. That's corporate science. Or they control politicians and give them jobs after they leave. Or they have a system of immunity at the top. In other words, the pushers of all these technologies around the world, which are changing the way farms are organized into industrial farms, replacing individual farmers in the millions in India, for example. I mean, these are real earth-shaking technologies, and they're just getting underway. But it's interesting that none of the bosses have any skin in the game. If there's a disaster for a nuclear plant, does anybody really think that the CEO of the company is going to be prosecuted for, at the least, involuntary manslaughter? No, there's no skin in the game. Whenever you have a hierarchy of corporate power, which concentrates power politically, economically, technologically, to control workers and go anywhere in the world to escape stronger laws, you have an immunity that's extremely dangerous at the top, pulling all the strings. And if something goes wrong, you know, they may leave and resign, but they resign with millions of dollars and 10 homes. So this symposium is about understanding the risks of these technologies. The companies always promote the benefits perceived, even though they're fake. For example, genetically modified crops do not increase yield, are not more nutritious. They are now facing mutating weeds, so Monsanto has to develop even stronger herbicides in a vicious circle to keep in business. But the costs are almost never discussed. No congressional hearings, very few articles, a book here and there. I introduced one that just came out called The GMO Deception on genetically engineered crops. So we're living in an extremely dangerous period here when you have these runaway technologies. And you can see it with the Silicon Valley, with Facebook, with the surveillance that's now possible by the NSA. And there is no framework, ethical and legal framework, to restrain them. And that means there's a lot of danger now and there's a lot of danger ahead. That's what this symposium is addressing here in New York City at the Venerable Cooper Union Great Hall.
I wanted to ask you about a thing you mentioned earlier, which was corporate science versus academic science. And the Koch brothers, Monsanto, Novartis, are some of the companies pouring a lot of money into university research. How is that different from what's gone on before? And what are the inherent dangers of for-profit companies financing all this research?
Well, it's been going on before, but it's much more vitriolic now. For example, 50, 60 years ago, DuPont, Dow Chemical, the pesticide makers would go and try to hire professors to tout their wares. They'd give them stock. They'd pay them as consultants. But now it's so much greater quantitatively and qualitatively. I mean, you have corporations that actually have presence, like Novartis on Berkeley campus, University of California. The Whitehead Institute at MIT is corporate. They can appoint certain professorships. They can push graduate students with good money to go into their areas of research instead of what a graduate student would go into, preferably. They give their professors a conflict of interest. You know, by day they're teaching students, and by night they're hustling for these corporations. And the students don't know that their professor is taking money from corporations that may affect his teaching and research or her teaching and research. So it's much, much more prevalent. And so you have books written like from Mish Washburn, University Inc., The Corporatizing of Universities. And every step becomes more autocratic. They start going after professors that challenge them. Whistleblowers get pushed around and stripped of their career and sometimes persecuted in the courts. So it keeps getting worse and worse. And you know, a society that allows commercial values to subordinate civic values, health, safety, respect for posterity, respect for the environment, openness of science, accountability of science and technology. When that happens, society's in decay. I mean, every time we've progressed in our country's history, it's because we subordinated commercial values to human values and told the commerce they had to adjust. Like when we abolished child labor, we told, over 100 years ago, our country told the big factories, you can't hire these kids 8, 9, 10 years old in dungeon factories. They should be going to school, hire their parents, and the corporations adjust it. And when the auto companies didn't want to put in seat belts for years and padded dash panels, when the law was passed and said to GM and Ford and Chrysler, you're not making that decision anymore about who lives or dies, whether a car has seat belts or airbags or not, you're going to do it. And they adjusted. They made money off of it. They advertise it now. So we've got to have a rule of law here. And in order to do that, people have got to stop just being exposed to propaganda and commercial advertising that says, gee whiz, all this great technology. You see it every day, every hour on TV. And the TV has got to begin respecting that we own the public airwaves. And we're entitled to alternative views of the dangers of these technologies and how they're not being held accountable at the top of the corporations who have no skin in the game. No skin in the game is the biggest danger for accountability of the few who are controlling the many. Once you show that there's an immunity pattern that's institutionalized, you have gone to another dimension of decay in terms of an accountable society.
In terms of regulating technologies, potentially dangerous technologies, in theory, the government's supposed to oversee this with the various agencies that have been set up over the decades. But increasingly, I think a lot of people are looking at our government as bought and paid for by the big corporations. A lot of people see both our political and economic system as severely broken. And maybe there's a lack of enthusiasm to participate in electoral politics because of things like the perception that everybody's bought and paid for, and the perception that Supreme Court decision like Citizens United and McCutcheon have really created an uneven playing field to be even more uneven and puts the average citizen at a disadvantage. So your prescription often, you know, through the decades of your activism is to become active, organize congressional district by congressional district. If we only had that kind of organizational power that we could influence. But what's your feeling now when so many people think this system is inherently broken and for the foreseeable future not repairable?
Well, it is rigged. I mean, the power is in the hands of fewer and fewer giant corporations who control most of the government agencies. Department of Defense, Department of Treasury, Department of Agriculture. You know, that's all been well documented. But you mentioned an uneven playing field. Well, one reason it's uneven is not just the power of corporations. There's no one on the playing field on the other side, hardly. I mean, you can't hold the auto industry accountable with just four or five people full-time in Washington like Joan Claybrook, Clarence Ditlow, myself, trying to monitor the Department of Transportation. Maybe you need 20. Maybe you need 30. It's still nothing in terms of numbers. So just a few people representing the concerns of millions of people, they want safe cars, safe food, clean air, can make a huge difference. And we got to start asking the question, how do we get the funding? How do we get these new groups or strengthen existing groups who are watchdogs in Washington so that the laws that are on the books can be enforced? There's some very good laws on the books in air, water pollution, pesticide control. I mean, they can be better, but they're not enforced for the most part. And second, recognize that most of these new technologies have no regulation. There's no real regulation, just guidelines for genetic engineering. There's virtually nothing for nanotechnology. More and more pesticides are coming on, and the EPA doesn't even have the budget. EPA's budget is equal to the Star Wars budget of missile defense, which MIT scientists have said is a boondoggle. It won't work against ballistic missiles. It has a $9.5 billion budget. That is the budget of the entire Environmental Protection Agency. So these chemical industries are pouring this stuff out. Synergy is not analyzed when two chemicals are in presence, or three or four at once. Now, it doesn't take that much. For example, there are a lot of retired scientists, engineers from reputable institutions. Why don't they organize themselves? I mean, how many times can you play shuffleboard? Why don't they organize themselves and become watchdogs? Now, it doesn't have to be full-time. With the internet, they can have a huge impact. Now, some law professors have done that, led by a law professor in Maryland. They have a network of about 70 law professors who are skilled in spotting regulatory problems and lack of enforcement in the environmental, worker safety, and consumer area. And they're doing a great job on a $500,000 budget at the most, a year. They volunteer their time. They put out incisive reports. Now, what if some retired communication specialist, what if they organized a network so that these kinds of reports could get on more media? In other words, there are millions of retired, skilled people who are fretting away. They're getting bored. Their children, grandchildren are not looking up to them because they may not know the latest iPhone 6 gadget. And they can really become a real force. It doesn't take that much. It's a lot easier than we think. And people say, look at Ralph, look at all you've done. Yeah, but the lesson is that if you have a sense of strategy and commitment, keep a sense of humor, let others take the credit, keep working every day where the decisions are made or not made, you can have huge leverage. Why? Because you have the power of knowledge and the power of public opinion behind you. And it's no longer left-right. When you're dealing with hazards, dangers, whether you have conservative family, liberal family, they're worried about their kids. They're worried about the air, water, food. When you get down where people live, work, and raise their families, this nonsense divide and rule ideology that the power structure separates, red state, blue state, left, right, conservative, liberal, starts to vaporize. It starts to vaporize. When a conservative family's kids are coming down with leukemia because of toxics that are seeping into the cellars of a housing project, I don't think they're going to be much worried about what Milton Friedman wrote about.
I wanted to ask you about climate change, and I think everybody was impressed here in this country and around the world that 400,000 people came out for the People's Climate March on September 21st. But there was a current going around, maybe in part because of the publication of Naomi Klein's new book, This Changes Everything, where she really takes a look at the compatibility or incompatibility of capitalism with what we need to do as a planet to wean ourselves off of fossil fuels and make the changes necessary so that we don't crash this planet. And I'm wondering, you know, in the many years you've been involved in, being active to try to rein in runaway corporate power and, what's at stake now in terms of climate change, do you think we need an incredible overhaul of our economic system to make the changes necessary to survive?
Yeah, I think corporate capitalism, multinational, global, is on an omnicidal trajectory. I think if whether you want to replace them or save them from themselves, if they are not controlled with boundaries, the trajectory of climate change and land erosion and just exhaustion of precious resources for short-term profit goals is omnicidal. Definitely. I mean, they could destroy the Amazon just because they want to expand cattle farming, for example. Can you think what that does to the world? So they have no discernible limits. That's the danger of commercialism. They have no boundaries. Enough is never enough. You say to General Electric, when is your profit enough? Enough is never enough. That's the definition of runaway, uncontrolled commercialism that is not boundaried by the rule of law, by public opinion, by litigation, by citizen lobbying, and all the other things that you have on your sterling radio station, Scott. So my point is this, that there are certain things that when the corporations meet irresistible public force, public opinion force, and challenging benign technologies like solar energy, they say to themselves, you know, hey, this is a place to make money. We're going to go into the solar industry. Well, you know, it doesn't pay anymore. All we do is, you know, we're getting bad looks at our country club because we're polluting, we're coal barons, we're oil giants. They will adapt just the way they adapted to some things in the past, like airbags and seatbelts. On the other hand, we really have to have a strategy of displacement. We have to have more community economies that are locally controlled. We know who's giving us renewable energy or fruits and vegetables or community health clinics focused on prevention or transportation services that are local. And that undermines the sales of these giant banks and ExxonMobil and so forth. That is what I call an economic community strategy of displacement. And that's growing fast in this country. Not fast enough, but we're talking tens of billions of dollars all over the country. The other thing is that let's not exaggerate the opposition. If you are so brilliant in your exposés and your disclosures of bad corporate doings, you tend to exaggerate them. And when you exaggerate their power, you induce among mass of people a discouragement. They become demoralized. You know, what's the use? Whatever will be, the big boys will make the decisions. And that's very dangerous. The other exaggeration that's debilitating is the 400,000 who turned out in New York. This reminds me of 1999 in Seattle, when 100,000 people went up there and they protested against the World Trade globalization, you know, the coming NAFTA, actually NAFTA was already in place, and so was the WTO, World Trade Organization. Well, for years after that, people who were involved in the movement kept remembering so fondly Seattle. Oh, it's Seattle. Wasn't Seattle wonderful? Seattle really put the boundary on globalization. No, it was just a start. It was a wonderful start. But they kind of wallowed in that one upsurge of civic energy that was focused on where the big corporate bosses were meeting and their government allies were meeting in Seattle at the time. And what happened? Well, 15 years later, there hasn't been another Seattle, a few protests here and there. There hasn't been another Seattle. It didn't grow. It didn't institutionalize. And now we're not only faced with NAFTA and WTO, we're faced with a president who broke his campaign promise in 2008 to redefine NAFTA, and now wants the Pacific Trade Agreement to come to Congress in order to make it even worse in terms of subordinating labor, environmental, and consumer concerns to the imperative of commercial international trade. However, we have a left-right coalition in the House in defiance of Speaker John Boehner and Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi to block the Pacific Trade Agreement on a procedural issue called fast track. And so that's an example of we've got to win with left-right alliance. The left doesn't win by itself. The right doesn't win by itself. When they have common agreement and common objectives, they band together, they're unstoppable, which is the title of my new book.
Well, just a last question, Ralph. I think most people who know your work would presume you're an optimist because you work day in and day out like the Dickens, and you've won a lot of battles, you've lost some, there are many yet to be won, But I'm wondering, as you look to the future in terms of some of these critical issues like climate change and the degradation of the planet and our ecosystem, are you optimistic we're going to turn back in time?
There's no function to pessimism, Scott. It's a vanity. It's an intellectual indulgence. So that doesn't mean you got pie in the sky and you're kind of euphoric about the future. But you have to be optimistic functionally to continue, not to be discouraged, to be resilient, to be more creative, to let your last defeat be your best teacher. So just looking at it functionally, that is very important. Unfortunately, the younger generation is very prone, and all young generations, to the sensitive young generation. They're prone to discouragement, to lowering their morale, to becoming cynical, to withdrawing into their own personal pursuits or addictions. And that's who we have to pay more attention to. We've got to show the younger generation that if you like anything about the world, go ask who started it. And it usually starts with one or two people. And they could have easily been discouraged. One or two people against, you know, all the men in the industrial factories who didn't want women to have the right to vote. I mean, how about that for six women meeting in an upstate New York farmhouse in the mid-1840s? So that's what we've got to do. And our generation is not spending enough time with the younger generation. We're almost intimidated. There are parents who are afraid of their own children, for heaven's sake. Just because their children know the new technology and they kind of lord it over and ridicule, you know, the older people. What are you talking about? I tell the young people in my office, you want a race? I'll produce more copy from my Underwood typewriter than you'll produce in your latest Mac computer. You want a race? And when the when the storm comes and the lightning comes and the lights go out, I'm still typing.
Thank you, Ralph Nader. Appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Scott. Thanks for your great radio station in Bridgeport, Connecticut.
Thank you for that. And thanks for all your important work.